So there's an episode which occurs. In fact, I might be stealing Rat Nagosha's thunder and telling you the stories that he's going to tell you, but I hope not. There's an episode which occurs after the Buddha's enlightenment, when he's walking from Bodh Gaya to the deer park at Saranath, where his previous companions, the five ascetics, are living and still practicing austerities. On his journey, he meets Upaya, a naked ascetic, not an unfamiliar sight in India. He would have had dreadlocks, his body black and weathered by the sun. But clearly the sight of the Buddha was unfamiliar to Upaya. He is bemused by his appearance, by his radiance, and by his bearing. And he asks him, "Who are you? Are you a yaksha?" A yaksha apparently is a spirit who lives in the jungle. "Are you a Gandharva, a celestial musician? Are you a deva, a divine being?" And lastly, apparently for Upaya the most unlikely, "Are you a human being?" And the Buddha doesn't simply say no. He says, "Those conditions on account of which I might have been described as a yaksha, a Gandharva, a deva, or a human being have been destroyed. Therefore am I a Buddha." So the sangskaras, the whole range of conditioned mental attitudes, whether that be family, cultural, racial, gender conditionings, and even those conditions which bring us into this world in a human form, have all been dissolved in Shakyamuni's enlightenment experience. So the Buddha was free from all conditioning. He was in human form, but his consciousness was completely free of limitations. Unlimited by time, by space, by causality. He was reality embodied in human form. Upaya continues to be bemused. We are told that being unable to fit the appearance of the Buddha into any of his categories, he shook his head and went on his way. So it's such a story, isn't it? One of the first people to meet the Buddha, and he doesn't stay with him. We might laugh at his foolishness, but we might be laughing at ourselves also. We're probably doing something very similar in imagining we might know what Buddhas do. I'm probably doing something similar in thinking that I might be able to tell you. Almost inevitably, we think about things by inferring from our own experience. We might think it's the same kind of question, if we're asking it in question form, what do Buddhas do? We might think it's the same kind of question as saying, or as asking, what do engineers do? What do farmers do? What do artists do? And by replying to that question, They create food, they build bridges and roads, paint pictures. We find out what their particular role is. So with these names and these categories, we're distinguishing one role from another. We think because we can name something, we can know it. But Buddhas cannot be seen as a category in this sense. They cannot be defined. They have transcended all roles and conditioning. They are one with reality. Their path is described as being like that of birds in the sky, leaving no trace. Their actions are described as akiriya, beyond karmic conditionality. So I'm very aware in giving this talk that I'm likely to be bringing my idea of the Buddha. I'm likely to be bringing the idea of the Buddha down to my own level of consciousness. But But at the same time, this question, what do Buddhas do, can be a very helpful one. I was remembering when I worked in Bodywise at the LBC, I was working with another Dharmacharini called Sri Sambhavar, and she was working a lot in the reception area. And when things got very, very tough in the reception area, apparently Sri Sambhavi used to think, what would the Buddha do in this situation? But we do have stories, descriptions and teachings of the Buddha passed down to us, which give us pointers, clues and something to respond and relate to. If we can receive these stories and teachings with an open mind, which is not too quick to categorize, we can begin to have a sense of what Buddhas do. So I've heard that Maitreya Bandhu left you some weeks ago with the image of Shakyamuni sitting under the Bodhi tree, having attained complete liberation, fully and perfectly awake, and then opening his eyes. We're told he then spent weeks absorbing that experience, and presumably enlightenment is not a single experience. It doesn't stop unfolding. And during those weeks he sat under different trees beside the Naranjara River. One of his first actions was to move away from his seat under the Bodhi tree and sit a little distance away, gazing at the tree in gratitude. Gratitude for having been sheltered by it during this profound experience. The next event has been described by Sangharakshita as an astonishing episode. Shakyamuni is wondering who he can revere. He's aware that one suffers if dwelling without reverence or deference. One suffers if dwelling without reverence or deference. And he asks himself, what recluse or Brahmin is there under whom I could live, paying honour and respect? At the same time, he knows that in terms of spiritual insight and understanding, there is no one more developed than him. But that recognition does not leave him satisfied. If there is no being that he can revere, then he will revere the Dharma. Not the Dharma in the form of his own teachings, but the Dharma as reality. That irreversible creativity that continues to unfold. This is the Dharma that he is able to revere and worship. So what Sangharakshita sees as so astonishing and significant about this episode is that worship is an integral part of the enlightenment experience itself. The enlightened mind is a worshipping mind, no less than it is a realized mind or a compassionate mind. So already, before Shakyamuni is involved in any communication with others, we can see that Buddhas worship. They feel reverence, devotion and gratitude, something that is confirmed by Brahma Sahampati, the deity who attended on the Buddha over the time of his enlightenment, who appears and tells Shakyamuni that all the Buddhas of the past have likewise worshipped the Dharma. And what follows shortly after this incident is one of the most affecting and beautiful passages in the Pali Canon. Now, while the Blessed One was alone in retreat, this thought arose in him. The law that I have attained to is profound and hard to see, hard to discover. It is the most peaceful and superior goal of all, not attainable by mere reason, subtle for the wise to experience. But this generation relies on attachment, relishes attachment, delights in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth. That is to say, conditionality, dependent arising. And if I taught the law, others would not understand me. So the Buddha sees that the fundamental principle of his realization will not be understood by those who are full of craving, of desire, and of the ill will and hatred which comes of not getting what we desire. Those people may be able to understand intellectually, but not in such a way that they are motivated to change the conditions which give rise to that covetousness and ill will. And he goes on, this state too is hard to see, the resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, unbinding. And again, it's hard for us to envisage, to imagine that state of total liberation, that freedom from all limitations. So as the Blessed One reflected thus, his mind inclined to dwelling at ease and not to teaching the Dharma. So there's a cliffhanger at this point. And Brahma Sahampati, thank goodness, cries out, the world is lost, the world is destroyed, and then begs the Buddha to teach. He tells him there are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away because they do not hear the Dharma. He says there will be those who will understand the Dharma, and some indeed who will also awaken. And then we know the very familiar story of the Blessed One, having understood Brahma's invitation, surveys the world with the eye of an awakened one out of compassion for beings. And as he did so, he saw beings with little dust in their eyes and those with much, those with keen faculties and those with dull, those with good attributes and those with bad, those easy to teach and those hard. And they appear to him like a lake of lotuses. And what he says at this point is, wide open are the doors of the deathless. Let those who hear show faith. And this incident has always intrigued me. The Buddha doesn't have to teach. He doesn't have to respond. He's not a cosmic social worker. He's not going to impose. He needs to be invited. There's obviously something significant in the question as to whether he should try to communicate his experience. He's not simply being indolent or having a day off. He says it would be wearying for him and he can remain in a state of ease. Then I thought about the image of what's known as the directionless, the door of liberation that is in relation to the lakshana of dukkha, of suffering. So the image of Aparinihita is a perfect sphere on a perfectly level ground. In the enlightened consciousness, there is no effort or bias. It is not driven by craving, however subtle. But that ease and perfect poise also means that the Buddha can move spontaneously in any direction in response to what is needed. So he decides to teach the Dharma, and the world breathes a sigh of relief. He sets out on his first journey, the journey on which he met Upaya, to find the five ascetics, his former companions, and share his experience with them. As this is recorded in the Pali text, the teaching is presented as a formal exposition of the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, but it's generally agreed that this is a later interpolation. What passed between the Buddha and his companions, we don't know. We're told that it lasted a number of weeks, and we can imagine both the warmth and intensity of that communication. At a certain point, Kondanya also realizes the truth of conditionality and becomes an arahant and takes on the name Anatta Kondanya, Kondanya who knows. We're told that the earth shook and trembled when this happened, and it gives a sense of the energy released by it being possible for the Buddha to communicate to at least one person what was crucial in his experience and for that person to see what he had seen. So this memorable meeting with the five ascetics was the first of so many during the 50 years which followed, of teaching and wandering. when Shakyamuni engaged with people from every walk of life, princes, kings and queens, ascetics and householders, beggars and lepers, farmers and tradesmen, housewives and prostitutes, old and young, men and women, even to the last hours of his life. When lying sick and dying, with his companion Ananda trying to protect him from demands, he tells Ananda to admit the wanderer Subhadra, whom he teaches and ordains into the community of monks there and then. So we could say, what Buddhas do is teach the Dharma. But again, it would be easy to think we know what that meant. We might have an idea of the Dharma as a body of knowledge which the Buddha communicates whenever there is the opportunity, almost as if the Dharma is separate from the Buddha and is now something we can access on the internet. We have to remember that the Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. What he engages in those 50 years is spontaneous, compassionate activity rather than teaching the Dharma as we might understand it. He responds fully to whoever he is in relation to, aware of their suffering, intuitively aware of their world and their concerns and what could be meaningful to them. He teaches not so they can acquire knowledge, but to turn their world inside out and upside down, to help them see the truth of suffering, the conditions that give rise to it, and that there is another way to live, which brings the joy and contentment of acting for the good, of friendship and harmony, and a guiding vision with total liberation as its goal. Wide open is the door of the deathless. Let those who hear have faith. In a commentary on a text called the Kadampa Precepts, Bhante Sangharakshita emphasizes that in the Buddha's day there was no generalized Dharma teaching, that the Buddha was always talking to somebody. He was giving people what they needed to practice where they were. And that the scriptures of today were the precepts of yesterday. Precept in the sense not of a general rule of training, as in the 5 or the 10 precepts, but something significant and particular to the person at that moment in time. The Buddha's teaching was intimate, concerned with the individual and what they needed, what they could use right there and then. It's important to bear that in mind when we ourselves are teaching the Dharma. Have we really taken in where this person is coming from, what their world might be like, what would be meaningful for them? Otherwise, we are in danger of what Bhante refers to as holy waffle. So a couple of comments in relation to this. In Asanga's chapter on ethics, he talks about the ethics of attuning the mind to others, what we would probably call empathy. He talks about the bodhisattva as knowing the dispositions, nature and elements of sentient beings, knowing them in order to help beings move from unskillful to skillful mental states. Their dispositions, both present and habitual, will affect how they hear what you say. Their nature will give a sense of what path of practice that person inclines to. And the elements in this case is their personal character or typology. And the example is given of not by Asanga, but elsewhere, that a hate type would benefit from a beautiful, comfortable retreat centre with lovely food. In a similar vein, Vimalakirti admonishes Purna for teaching the Dharma mechanically. So Vimalakirti, as you know, is speaks in a very forceful way, in one way or another. And this is what he says to Purna. Reverend Purna, first concentrate yourself. Regard the minds of those young bhikshus and then teach them the Dharma. Do not put rotten food into a jeweled bowl. First understand the inclinations of these monks. Reverend Purna, without examining the spiritual faculties of living beings, do not presume upon the one-sidedness of their faculties. Do not wound those who are without wounds. Do not impose a narrow path upon those who aspire to a great path. Do not try to pour the great ocean into the hoofprint of an ox. Do not confuse the brilliance of the sun with the light of the glowworm, and do not expose those who admire the roar of a lion to the howl of a jackal. So I thought maybe this would be a good text for those of us who lead study, to study. So, to Kisa Gotami, who approaches the Buddha with her dead child in her arms, her only son, hoping for a miracle, Shakyamuni sends her on a quest to collect medicine, grains of mustard from a house in which no one has died. After she has tried to carry out this impossible quest, there is no further need of a teaching, and she goes for refuge to the Buddha. To his son Rahula, who has been entertaining covetous thoughts about what life might have been like if the Buddha had not renounced the house life and been instead a universal monarch, Shakyamuni intuits his thoughts and cuts to the quick of his craving by giving a direct teaching on not self. Rahula, any kind of material form whatsoever, whether past, future or present, in oneself or external, coarse or fine, far or near, should all be regarded as it actually is. This is not mine. This is not what I am. This is not myself. Rahula puts down his bowl for the alms round and, chastened, goes instead to meditate. To Meghia, who sees a charming and inviting mangrove grove where he would rather spend time meditating than attending to the Buddha, he tells him that while the heart's release is still immature, five things lead to its maturity. The first being good friends and companions. The second, the practice of ethics. The third, talk about the Dharma. The fourth, energy in pursuit of the good. And the fifth, the development of wisdom. And that all these stem first and foremost from being in the company of good friends. To Angulimala, the bandit, he merely walks at a normal pace ahead of him. While Angulimala, going as fast as he can in order to kill him, is unable to catch up with him and shouts, "Stop! Stop!" Shakyamuni replies, "I have stopped, Angulimala. Do you stop also?" And goes on to say, "I have stopped forever for swearing violence to every breathing thing." So this is the Buddha's teaching of the Dharma, an intimate, personal communication, a response to that individual, attuned to their world and to the way in which they suffer, engaging with their need and showing what can be the next step towards the total liberation of a consciousness that is fully awake. And we know also that the Buddha gathered a community. He brought into being a Sangha. But again, what do we understand by this? was the wider Sangha of all those who had gone for refuge to the Buddha, recognizing that to whatever extent that what he had taught, what he embodied, was the truth about existence. And there were those who also took admission to the monastic community. The Sangha was radical. It altogether subverted the views which maintained the caste system in India. There was no place for caste discrimination in the Sangha. It was also radical in admitting women as disciples of the Buddha as fully as men. The Sangha was the first community in which metta bhavana was practiced. Prior to that, in the Indian religions, there had been no emphasis on Maitri. The Buddha was also unique in not asking anyone to accept his teaching as a matter of authority or out of respect for him. My words should be accepted by the wise, not out of regard for me, but after due investigation, just as gold is accepted as true only after heating, cutting and rubbing. The Sangha enabled a hugely significant social revolution to take place, both within and with reverberations without that community, as well as providing supportive conditions for spiritual practice. But there was a further and perhaps even more crucial spiritual element. The Sangha itself was practice. We know very well the Buddha's conversation with Ananda, his companion, in which he asserts that Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship, or friendship with the spiritually and ethically beautiful, is the whole of the spiritual life. But even this can be interpreted as simply meaning friendship between the teacher and disciple, or between a small group of disciples who live and practice together. It is our teacher, Sangharakshita, who has emphasized this aspect of the Buddha's teaching so strongly and enabled us to see so much more of its potential. It's as though this conversation of the Buddha with Ananda is a terma. A terma is a tantric word, meaning a hidden spiritual treasure which may not be discovered until the time when conditions are right for the teachings to flourish. So very early on in my involvement with the movement, I heard about a conversation Bhante had had with a woman who was regularly involved at one of our centres. I didn't speak to the woman myself, so I can't vouch for the accuracy of this story. But it certainly communicated something to me. Apparently she went to see Bhante at a point when she was wondering whether to ask to become a Mitra. And she asked him whether there were any stream entrants in the order at that time. An interesting question. I imagine for her it was about the need for some kind of guarantee that this order and movement was the real McCoy, that our practices are effective, and that if she was going to commit her time and her energy and her heart, a guarantee that in the longer term there would be significant personal results. Bhante's reply, thus have I heard, was also interesting. He said he thought she was putting the cart before the horse, or words to that effect. That if she did decide of her own free will to make that commitment to becoming a Mitra, then she would be contributing to the conditions from which stream entrants arise. In other words, she would be committing herself to help build a spiritual community. It's not simply that a spiritual community provides supportive conditions for our own practice, which it certainly does. It's that we begin to see that this idea of our own practice can be quite limited. In reality, we are not the separate selves that we imagine. If we practice the spiritual life as though we are a separate self, with the idea of spiritual development as something that we acquire, add on to ourselves, then our experience will almost certainly be one of frustration. So a spiritual community is not there simply to provide supportive conditions. It's to do with the very nature of what we are trying to do by practicing spiritually. This generation relies on attachment, relishes attachment, delights in attachment. The greatest attachment is to our self-view, what are known as the Atma-kleshas, ignorance about self, belief in self, pride in self, and love of self, from which all other kleshas or veils of ignorance stem. The sense of ourselves as the center of the universe, what's sometimes been described as the me sadhana. So there's a remarkable statement that Bhante made in an extract from a seminar on a text called Mind in Buddhist Psychology. And the extract, unfortunately, has a rather complex title. It's called The Bi-Tendential Value of Being. And in this sense, being is equivalent to reality. And in that seminar transcript, Bhante says, you, with inverted commas round the you, cannot gain reality or enlightenment. You cannot gain reality or enlightenment. It is only you plus others who can. So Bhante goes on to expand on this when he describes the perceptual situation, which is our basic experience. There's a continuum in our experience, but there are two poles, a subjective and an objective pole. And he says, the subjective pole is the experience of what I call myself, together with everything I have under my immediate control. The other objective pole is everything and everyone that is independent of my direct control. And he says, when one becomes enlightened, that perceptual situation still occurs, but one no longer identifies with its subjective content, which means the whole perceptual situation is expanded, clarified, illuminated, enlightened. So I've always found this a very helpful model for understanding what goes on. It's not just that one is concerned with myself in the sense of body, thoughts, emotions, identity. The attachment is also to everything I appear to have under my control, everything I think of as being mine, whether it's my ideas, my views, my car, my house, whatever it might be. And the objective pole is everything not under my control, which could be either neutral or threatening or something which I desire to include and to make mine, to make, bring to my end of things. And this is what is going on to some extent most of the time, wherever we are. But where there is friendship, real friendship, it starts to break open. The other becomes as important, even sometimes more important than oneself. So we start to identify with the other as much as or even more than we do with ourselves. And in a spiritual community, we are constantly expanding our capacity for friendship. And when we retreat back into the subjective pole, the discordance, the limitation of that is highlighted in the spiritual community. So we're very familiar with Sangharakshita emphasizing the importance of having emotional equivalents for our intellectual understandings. This is what he's said many times, that we need emotional equivalents for our intellectual understandings. But we may not realize that early on in his teaching, he said that the emotional expression of the Anatta doctrine, the doctrine of not self, is friendship. And the description of the perceptual situation enlightened is so attractive. When you attain enlightenment, the element of resistance to the objective content is no longer there. You no longer have a will that is separate from that of others. It's as though you utterly identify with others and what they are doing. You don't experience another person as a kind of brick wall that you're coming up against, and you no longer experience yourself as a conflicting solid force. Your will is not coming into collision with theirs. The world is the same, but you see it differently. Perhaps you could say it's like what happens when you fall in love, only much more so. Even though everything is there as before, the world looks almost physically different. So enlightenment has the dimension of gratitude, of devotion, reverence and worship. It also has the dimension of friendship. It's not merely that in a spiritual community we are each other's conditions. It's that we are each other. Shantideva talks about this as the practice of a bodhisattva in his Bodhicharyavatara. The practice of exchange of self and other, in which it is irrelevant whether it is my suffering or your suffering. There is simply suffering, which must be alleviated. You could maybe also say that it is irrelevant whether I or you become a stream entrant. What matters is that we create the conditions of spiritual community out of which stream entrants can arise. So Buddhas gather a community. They create a Buddha field from their influence, from their adhisthana. And that Buddha field is a field of living beings who grow through the influence of the Buddha. And their own aspirations, their going for refuge, creates its own momentum, expanding the Buddha field. Sometime after Kondanya became the first arahant, we are told that a further 60 monks became enlightened. Then the Blessed One addressed them. Go now and wander for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, welfare and happiness of gods and men. Teach the law which is good in the beginning, good in the middle and good in the end, in the spirit as well as in the letter. There are beings with little dust on their eyes who will be lost through not hearing the law. Some will understand. So for the last few weeks, I've been carrying this postcard reproduction around with me. It was waiting for me in my room at Tiruttaniloka when I came back from a period caring for my mother, which had been quite a difficult week. It was from my dear friend Vajratara, who had left for a retreat at Bodh Gaya. She said on the card, that she knew things weren't easy for me at that time, but she would salute the Buddha for me in Bodh Gaya and send metta from under the Bodhi tree. So it's an image of the Buddha and Ananda, who was the Buddha's friend and companion for 30 years, and I see you've got quite a large reproduction of it in your bookshop here. So I'll just describe it for those of you who may not have noticed it. So the Buddha and Ananda are walking through the fields of India. You can see that their robes dyed with the earth, because their robes are very much the colour of the earth through which they're walking. And they're elderly. The Buddha has grey stubble on his head. Ananda has slightly darker stubble. And they're turning to face each other. And their faces are very warm. And their eyes are really engaged with each other. They're really looking at each other. They're really catching each other's glance. It's you can't tell whether they're speaking or just smiling as they walk. And Ananda is reaching out with one hand to offer support to the Buddha as he walks, and the Buddha holds a gnarled wooden staff. So it's a lovely image. And it was painted by Amita Jyoti, who's a Dharmacharini who lives and has her studio near the London Buddhist Centre. I first saw this image on the convention, where we always have a space for order members to exhibit. I think it might have been a watercolour at that time, so it was obviously her beginning drawings for this of this image. And I thought the postcard was a reproduction of that, but apparently it's a painting from that original drawing, which was commissioned by the Birmingham Buddhist Centre. And somebody told me, I think it was Vajratara told me, it was as big as a door, the painting at the Birmingham Centre. So this image has been with me at Tiruchirappalli, at my mother's house in Porthmadog in North Wales, at Adishtana, where we've just had the college meeting. And I'm just thinking how it was given to me by my friend who I live and work with and who I'm also preceptor to. I conducted her ordination over 10 years ago, leading her through the same Pali words in call and response that were spoken by those who went for refuge to Shakyamuni Buddha. So a real sense of that lineage. And I'm thinking of Amita Jyoti, who was very committed, who is very committed to working and living as a practicing artist within Tri Ratna. Not an easy task. She shares her studio, but I imagine a lot of her time painting is quite solitary. She has a different lifestyle from me and Vajratara, but the same commitment. And the sense of the three of us connected with each other in this simple way through a postcard, all part of the same community and all connected strongly to the Buddha and Ananda. And I haven't met all or many of you, although there's quite a lot of people I recognise, but immediately I know that we are part of the same community. And when I first came along to the FWBO, as it was then, the Cambridge Centre hadn't even been thought of. I don't think it was even a twinkle in someone's eye. There was the London Buddhist Centre, Glasgow, Brighton, Norwich centres, maybe a small centre in Manchester. But there was no Sangha here, as far as I'm aware. So I just want to end by saying that we are a precious community, in the lineage of the Buddha, and long may we expand and flourish, spreading the Dharma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end.
Maitreyi told me at the beginning she wasn't feeling well and she wasn't sure if she'd be able to give much of a talk and so on. Thank you very much for the really good talk. I was just thinking that one of the things Maitreyi has been emphasising in her talk is friendship and community and sangha and so on, which obviously those of you who have heard me speaking, you know, that's what I've been emphasising here at the centre for some time. And it's the thing that seems to me that all of us can practice, whether we, you know, we may struggle with meditation, we might even struggle with ethics sometimes, but friendship we can all practice. It's both an easy and a difficult practice. It's easy because it's easy to know what to do. You just have to listen to people, take an interest in people, be with people. It's difficult because people, that's us, we're difficult, we're complex, we're awkward. And all we're trying to get to is a point where we can see that that's that's how it is, and that we don't have to identify with my awkwardness being superior to somebody else's. So I thought we will go for a tea break in a minute or two.